Acts chapter 2, and we, as we began our study of that second chapter last week, spent the entirety of our time in a discussion of the first four verses, tying them in with the promises that had been given by Christ concerning the establishment of the kingdom and the significance of that day of Pentecost when, as the disciples were gathered together in one place, there was the sound from heaven as of a rushing mighty wind. It filled the whole house where they were sitting. There appeared to them cloven tongues like as into fire, and one set upon each of them. And they were filled with the Holy Spirit, and to speak in tongues as the Spirit gave them utterance. So with those things in mind, in verse 5 and continuing, what we have is as we continue on, and I think that it's delineated that way in the outline that you have. After talking about the baptism of the Spirit, there is a few verses 5 through 13 wherein the audience that would receive the teachings of Peter and the apostles is identified. And then verses 14 through 36 contain the gospel message that was proclaimed by Peter on this occasion. First time there is a recorded message of the gospel in the gospel age with regard to what we as a part of the last days must do to be saved, stated first of all here on this occasion. So it's a very significant event. But let's just spend a few moments as we begin our time together in reading verses 5 through 13. I'm going to begin our discussion by looking at what the text says concerning those individuals that were there on that occasion, on that day. So if you begin with me, verse 5, going through verse 13 of the text. There were dwelling in Jerusalem Jews, devout men from every nation under heaven. And when the sound occurred, the multitude came together and were confused, because everyone heard them speak in his own language. Then they were all amazed and marveled, saying to one another, "Look, are not all these who speak Galileans? And how is it that we hear each in our own language in which we were born? Parthians and Medes and Elamites, those dwelling in Mesopotamia, Judea, Cappadocia, Pontus, and Asia, Phrygia and Pamphylia, Egypt, and the parts of Libya adjoining Cyrene, visitors from Rome, both Jews and proselytes, Cretans and Arabs, we hear them speaking in our own tongues the wonderful works of God." And they were all amazed and perplexed, saying to one another, "Whatever could this mean?" Others, mocking, said, "They are full of new wine." Now, there are basically three things that I want to derive from the text. First of all, I want you to note that these individuals were drawn by the sound. And so the sign, or signs, excuse me, that were given in Acts chapter 2 and verses 1 through 4 were not witnessed solely by the disciples to whom they appeared, or to whom the Spirit visited. The sign was audible, as we mentioned last week, as well as visible with regard to the sound of the rushing mighty wind, and then the cloven tongues like fire that set upon each of them. The sound that was heard drew this multitude. Questions have been raised. What we normally make note of here in this particular text is, or what we normally assume, is that this gathering was at the temple. It most probably was. It doesn't specifically say that, though. It doesn't explicitly say it. Now, there is a reference later to the fact that the Christians daily were with one accord in the temple. Most probably because of the size of the gathering that this was the temple, and the reference to the house that is stated previous there where they were sitting, the house where they were sitting. The word house there does not specifically have reference to a residential domicile. It could have had very possibly a reference to the enclosures that surrounded the court of the temple. So Most probably what we're talking about because of the size of the crowd was that they were gathered at the temple. One of the commentators described this as being rooms that, again, ringed the outer wall of the temple, opened up into the courtyard. And they could have been there, and it would not have been, or would have been something that would have been understandable and obvious that that individuals in the courtyard of the large gathering on that day, that they would have been drawn by a sound, especially the sound as of a rushing mighty wind. Just imagine something that we're aware of somewhat in our part of the country, or tornadoes. And it's been said that the tornadoes sound like freight trains as they're coming by because of the noise of the wind and such. But imagine hearing a loud wind-like noise, and yet the air is still. In other words, the wind is not accompanying the noise; it's just the noise itself. But that's something that would cause a commotion and would be perceived as something that is unnatural, and so it would naturally draw them to the source. And it had filled the house where they were sitting, so and they would come to it. And so we have a great crowd that were gathered together because they heard the sound. And we're told there that the multitude came together and were confused. Because in addition to the sound, now we have another demonstration. The threefold demonstration that is given in chapter 2 and verses 1 through 4 is the sound, the visible sign of the cloven tongues, or the tongues that were divided that appeared as fire or seemed to be like fire that set upon them. And then, finally, the fact that they began to speak in tongues. And this is the one that is commented upon by the group. So the first of the three things that we want to make note of is the fact that the multitude came together in response to one of the signs, the audible sign of the Spirit's baptism on this particular occasion. The second thing we want to make note of is the actual makeup of the crowd. Now, these were Jews, and there are two things that are to be noted. First of all, the fact that they were from nations conquered, or from nations, as indicated by the text, they came from every nation under heaven. Where is that phrase? Yes, in verse 5. They were dwelling in Jerusalem, devout men from every nation under heaven. And won't take the time to go through the list. If you want to take the time to do that on your own and look at those things, what seems to be true is that these, according to the, again, commentators that I made note of, even certain provinces outside of the formal scope of the Roman Empire were included in this list. But these were Jews, and the significant thing about that is the phrase in verse 5 that they were devout men. And we will again remind you that there were 3 days that were required by God as Jews to be observed, and you're talking about the atonement feast, the Passover feast, as well as the feast of Pentecost. And these individuals, in that they had come from far flung provinces, many of them, for the purpose of traveling to Rome. And I would again remind you that the events and circumstances of Acts chapter 2 in that day and time are far different from what we have today. I sometimes despair that that we as Christians in the Metroplex, with all the opportunities that we hear to hear the gospel preached in gospel meetings and such that require basically us to get in our car and spend 20 to 30 minutes going to another place, that we are loath to take that time to do that consistently and support other congregations in their gospel work, and benefit ourselves by edification, when you have individuals like this that would take many days' journey because of their feelings of responsibility with regard to their faith toward God, to go to this place on foot, travel long distances to get to Jerusalem for the purpose of observing the feast day. So these were individuals who were zealous, very devout, and individuals that were very careful to be obedient to the commands that God had given them in their faith. And so that in itself is something that is certainly commendable about them. So having said that, it is not surprising that there would be a significant number of those individuals that would respond well and appropriately to the preaching of the gospel. Good and honest hearts were present there on that occasion. Now, that is not to say that all were convinced, but that there were a great number who were by the preaching of truth. And I think that you can see a distinction made in the latter part of verses 12 and 13 of the text. And this is the third point that we want to make in verses 12 through 13. That may be made up, in the second slide on the matter. That there are two approaches to this. And again, this is an indication as to whether a heart is honest or not. Now, what they witnessed on this occasion, this multitude together, by the account that is given in the book, is two miracles. Now, it's kind of an interesting thing is the cloven tongues of fire that are mentioned. The Greek language, as you look at that, if I understand it correctly, are a couple of things. One would indicate that the tongues did not linger. There's something in the actual Greek language that would indicate that it was not something where the tongues were on them for the entirety of time, but it is something that appeared. It happened, and then perhaps there was a dissipation of it. But regardless of whether or not the cloven tongues remained, and perhaps it did, again, I don't know that that's an argument that is sufficiently strong to say that the people would not have witnessed it. But explicitly, two things are mentioned. Number one is they were drawn by the sound. And so here we have a miracle. There was a great rushing noise, like wind, that was evidence of the Spirit's visitation upon the disciples. No physical explanation could be given of it, because though the sound of wind was present, there was no wind present. And so this is something that caused confusion and led them to the place where the disciples were. So, first of all, they witnessed the miracle in the wind, or the sound of the wind, excuse me. Secondly, there was the witnessing, the audible witnessing of the wind. Secondly, the witnessing of the tongues, as mentioned in verse 6. We're told that when the sound occurred, the multitude came together and were confused. Why were they confused? Because everyone heard them speak in his own language. And so, here we have the 12 disciples who were preaching. Now, we have recorded for us, beginning in verse 14 and following, the message given by Peter. Again, one of two possibilities arise in that. One is that the other disciples ceased to speak while Peter spoke. More probably, we have, again, as they're saying that they spoke in their own language, we have different groups that were hearing the same basic message in their language, and what we have is recorded is the message that Peter spoke to the group that he was speaking to. But here we find individuals who were able to speak not in the common Greek, but rather in the dialect that was characteristic of each group that was there. And it was something that confused them. Well, why was that? Well, if you'll go down, we are told verse 11, it says, "We hear them speaking in our own tongues the wonderful works of God." And verse 7, this is the text we're referring to. "They were amazed and marveled, saying to one another, 'Look, are these not all who speak Galileans? And how is it that we hear each in our own language in which we are born?'" So the significance of this is that the Galileans, and again, understand as you look back that the Galileans were not individuals that were held in great esteem as a province, as a people, and they, in their perception, understand and recognize that these were common men, not men of learning, and yet we see a situation where they're able to speak in tongues that they had not learned. And so this was another miracle. So you had two miracles that had been witnessed. Obviously miracles that had been witnessed. And yet you had a group of individuals who dismissed it. Now, it's hard to dismiss a miracle. Other claims, unmerited or unconfirmed claims that are made, individuals may feel that they can reject out of hand. But when you have an individual who has just performed a miracle or who has been the recipient of a miraculous action by God in your presence, to then dismiss that out of hand as not being of any significance is something that takes, I think, a closed mind. And so you have two groups that are under consideration in this text. They are stated in verse 12 and 13. As they were all amazed and perplexed, they said to one another, "Whatever could this mean?" So here we have a group that understands the significance of these events, but they don't know why. But then it says in verse 13 that others, mocking, said that they are full of new wine. And so the scoffers on this particular occasion attributed the tongues to drunkenness. And the point that we want to make about this is that that on its face is something that is not a legitimate explanation. It is, in fact, not in need of refutation, because everyone with an open mind understands and recognizes that when you get drunk, though you may become gibberish, you may begin to speak in gibberish. In other words, your words may be slurred. You may be begin to speak nonsensically. Being drunk does not allow you to speak in a language that you've not learned. It does not. Alcohol does not contain such marvelous properties. Drunkenness leads to dissolution, not greater erudition. It just doesn't work that way. It's not something that necessarily had to be argued. And in fact, although Peter addresses it, I don't think that he really argues the point. He dismisses the point. He simply makes a simple statement that it's obviously they're not drunk. It's too early in the day to be drunk. Now, I understand that people can get drunk early in the day. It's simply a dismissive response to a ridiculous assertion. It's simply not so. It doesn't make any sense. Instead, what is happening is what was spoken of by Joel the prophet. And we'll talk about that a little bit as we continue on in it. But what you have is a closed mind. Now, remind you of another instance. You'll remember at the crucifixion of Christ, he died, was buried, was entombed in the new tomb for 3 days. Then the stone was rolled away and he was resurrected from the dead. And an explanation had to be given with regard to what happened. Well, we remember the fact that instructions were given to a Roman guard to set the stone and to guard the stone so that the disciples would not come and steal the body away, the latter deception being worse than the beginning. And so they did everything that they were supposed to do. Nevertheless, the body was gone because of the resurrection, and it was reported that the soldiers slept while the disciples came. It's a nonsensical explanation, and yet it was sufficient to convince many. It was the common story that was passed around with regard to the Jews or by the Jews, as the writer included, up until this day. So it was the common explanation. It's a ridiculous assertion. It makes absolutely no sense. Individuals who have half a mind can see through that if they desire to, if they have the open mind. And so the significance of this is that you have individuals who, no matter what, and this is an important point, no matter what might be done, no matter the signs and wonders that may accompany an event which serve to confirm and prove the veracity of the event and the power of the authority of those who are involved, doesn't matter. There are individuals whose minds are closed who will not accept it because their minds are closed. And so we need to recognize that is the case. Sometimes today people say, "Well, I would believe if a miracle were said in my presence or performed in my presence." And again, the word's already been confirmed. Those miracles are no longer needed. But the fact is that even as Jesus was among the people, and even as Jesus performed all the miracles that he did, the final sign being his resurrection from the dead, there were many who simply would not believe. And it wasn't because there was not sufficient evidence. It was because their minds were closed. Justin.
One of the two things. First, in terms of the divided tongues, I think there is plenty of evidence that shows that only showed themselves to the apostles. And when we went through the whole thing, they in verse 1 of the apostles because of verse 26 of chapter 1.
Right.
And so if you say they, then they, and it says that the tongues appeared to them.
Okay.
Specifically says that the apostles was the reason for us to confirm about the tongues.
Okay.
The second thing is, Luke's telling through 5 and 13, he's going through an escalation realization by the crowd. And the first thing that he said is the sound, all the things show up, and what's happening.
What's happening, right.
And the word alone is a confusing thing, but in the Greek, what it's saying is all that occurred in their own language. And then in verse 7, look around, all the yellow is how that we hear in our own dialect. Me talking to a New Yorker here and a New Yorker person. And then they go through all the country and say, we're hearing it in our own language. You know, you're hearing them sound a little funny in the language they already speak. We're hearing completely different languages.
Okay.
And the word, when they start, they're confused. And after that escalate, they're amazed and they're perplexed.
Okay. So the idea is there may not have been originally the recognition that these were actual, the miracle of tongues unlearned, but later it becomes evident that that is the case. Is that the point you're making?
Okay.
Yeah. Well, and that's an obvious. I mean, you know, all we would have to do is to just look at the way large groups work. Is that, you know, originally there's the milling around and confusion, and then as the thing dawns, the information spreads until more knowledge and everything is understood. And again, it is kind of an interesting thing the way it's put, because the astonishment and amazement and the fact that they were perplexed, as it's stated all the way down in verse 12. But again, ultimately what you get to is to that point to where there is no natural explanation for the circumstances. This is a supernatural event. And so, a natural explanation should be and was dismissed out of hand, especially the one that they came up with, which is absolutely absurd. Kelly.
I was going to say, you have to remember the context he's in with Jews and should have known what the law said concerning Jeremiah 31 and other passages of prophesied becoming king, as well as Jesus being with him. So it wasn't, I guess, could be a problem with a closed mind, but also an explanation for lack of knowledge.
Yeah.
Because we don't have the miracles today. Remember when Thomas Didymus insisted that he put his hand in Jesus' side to see the stars, and to decide to watch him believe. Jesus said, Thomas, because you have seen, you believe. Blessed yet more are those who have not seen.
Yeah, I agree with you with regard to that, Kelly. But at the same time, I think that what we do need to recognize is the number one, the shocking nature of the situation, and the momentary nature of this, in the sense that they're in the moment. I don't know exactly how to put that, but the fact that you have a group, even the group that we're told that they were perplexed, saying to one another, "Whatever could this mean?" That very well. Very possible that even those on that occasion, they may have been aware of the teaching of Jeremiah and the other passages which refer to that. But I mean, you're in the middle of, you're confused. It's a tumult. What's going on here? And the confusion could have been there. Now the indication, what happened was Peter told them what this was. This is that which was spoken of by the prophet Joel. And 3,000 responded to his message. So there were 3,000 that may have said, oh, okay, yes, this has been prophesied. We're aware of the prophecy. Look at this is what is indicated. So now, having said that, I do understand that ignorance of the law was certainly a problem among the Jews in the first century. It was the case, and could very well have led somewhat to this. But I think with regard to the actual initial response, what we have here that is significant is that there were undeniably miraculous manifestations of God's power that were present here. And there was the attempt on the part of some to deny the validity of those manifestations by attributing it to drunkenness. And such is an absurd thing. In fact, the drunkenness doesn't even deal with the sound, the inexplicable sound. And it certainly does not sufficiently describe how it could be or attribute or is attributable to the speaking in tongues either, so the languages. But again, it's an indication of two different mindsets that are present here. One that's confused, but the other is that has the closed mind. And I am assuming that it is from among those in verse 12 that were perplexed, saying, what could this mean, that the 3,000 that responded favorably to Peter's message came. Justin, do you have your hand up again?
Never mind.
Dennis?
One thing to remark about the line definitely proves there are those who put forth miracles within the years of the cures. If that were the case, the remark would not have been made. Miracles in the mouth of the apostles.
Yeah.
That definitely proves that. There's one other statement here that I've never really paid much attention to before. The nature of the preaching that's going on before Peter's first sermon. Apparently, there's been some substantial preaching and teaching that has been going on while he was speaking because of the remark of this individual that's being quoted. We hear them speaking in our own tongues, the wonderful works of God.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a mistake. I mean, we have that tendency to compress the time frame here, and while we sometimes have a difficult time being concise in our Bible classes, the Bible is always a marvel of conciseness with regard to its recounting of events. And I would think we could safely say that very little of what actually was said and accomplished on that day is recorded for us. Peter's message, and perhaps that's even a summary, I don't know, but Peter's message and the results of that are recorded for us. The rest of it is somewhat compressed. Whenever we see that kind of situation, again, one, you have to be careful about speculation. We don't want to go crazy going beyond what is actually contained in the text. Number two, it just reminds me of texts such as John 20. You remember in verses 30 and 31, where we are told by the writer John that there were many other things that Jesus did that are not written in this book, but these are written that you may believe, and believing have life in His name. So it was not the intent of his historians in the Gospels or the book of Acts to record everything that was accomplished and everything that was done. It was simply, if that were the case, our Bibles would be much thicker than they are. But it was the purpose to give us what is sufficient and needful for us to be mature, to be complete, as said in Timothy, 2 Timothy chapter 3. We have in Scripture that which is inspired all that we need to be perfect. But it doesn't by any means contain all that there is, or all that was accomplished, or all that was seen. So let's keep that in mind. Yes, Jim?
Can I like to say, too? I always believe that this is different than the gifts of tongues also. Because the apostles here are speaking, and everybody heard it in their own language. With the gift of tongues, there's always an interpreter needed. So I always thought that this is different than the gift of tongues that the apostles were given, because they needed an interpreter.
Okay. Well,
is that?
It may be a distinction without a difference. In other words, the gift of tongues was limited in its effectiveness in the first century church. It was a sign, and when you're talking about as far as the actual what was accomplished, the structure of it, that's what I was thinking, the structure, it's identical. I don't think that we can see any difference, because what you have are individuals on both occasions who were speaking in a language they had not learned. And it was a language. The tongue speaking that was so prevalent in the first century church was an impressive thing, because individuals, again, had the ability to speak in a tongue that they had not learned. What was often the case, however, and this is what the Apostle Paul dealt with in Corinth, is that there were individuals who had an ability to speak in a tongue. And what they were doing, because, and it's by definition, when you speak in a tongue, you're speaking by the Spirit's inspiration. And so these words are from God. Now, the ability to do that, to speak words that are from God, what's the significance of that? Well, if you speak words that are from God, then this is a message from God. This is something that needs to be heard. So those individuals in the church that were speaking these words from God, but they were speaking it and there wasn't anyone there who understood what they were saying, then it didn't help any. And that's why Paul restricted them to ensure that, and that's why he talked about the gift of prophecy. It is better to speak a word in a language that could be understood than 10,000 in a word in a language that could not. And so that's why the instructions were given to the disciples not to speak in tongues unless there is someone who had the ability to interpret that tongue so that what was said could be related to those present. So I think structurally exactly the same thing. Circumstance is certainly different. The speaking in tongues was not assigned to unbelievers in the church, in the assembly. In fact, the Apostle Paul indicated that it would be confusing to an unbeliever. These were messages that were being given by God and would be something that could edify the brethren. Here on this occasion, the apostles in the speaking in tongues were witnessing to unbelievers by their ability, but also they were enabled by God on that particular occasion to have the languages that were needful for these people to get the messages that they needed. So again, structurally, I think exactly the same. Now, the measures of the Spirit that we're going to be talking about when we bring our lesson on the subject of the Holy Spirit, very definitely different, because the baptism of the Holy Spirit only happened in Acts 2 and Acts 10. But again, structurally, I think it's identical. Yes, Kelly. On that occasion, and I may be miss. I have to go back. What's the passage? Because has that read? Yeah, it is. But they were misconstruing, and I did say that incorrectly. They were misconstruing the purpose of the tongue in the assembly. The way that they were not misconstruing, they were abusing the way in which the tongue was to be done, because what they were accomplishing in the assembly would be only confusion to those who would come in the assembly, those who are without, rather than accomplishing their intended purpose. So their practice in the church in Corinth was something that was inappropriate or done incorrectly. Okay. Okay, so interesting things, slowing us down, but that's okay. Ron, what do you have?
That's the original place where we start.
Okay. Okay.
And they're long.
Scoffing. Yeah. Again, you've got a mindset that was present there that's kind of ugly. It really is an ugly thing, but it's something that flies in the face of what was evident. And that's why I said it goes to the heart of the individual, because they see it. There's no way to deny what was going on, and they didn't even try to. They simply made fun of it, as you did. They scoffed at that this had any significance at all.
It doesn't interest their knowledge or anything else. It just interests an attitude.
Yeah, and that attitude is very prevalent in the first century, and is today as well. Yes, Richard.
You know, it's supposed to be in what? 3 million people at Pentecost at that time? Somewhere in that, I don't know where I got that number.
I actually mentioned that last week, that it may have been, because their estimates, and of course we don't know how accurate the estimates are, but during the Passover feasts in AD 70, when Jerusalem was besieged, that there were up to 3 million Jews who were in the city at that time. So there were large gatherings at the very least.
And these people are something that has been all their life from the first breath on that time. They've been steeped into the Old Testament law. Mm-hmm. They've got a new law. 3 million people. Some people think, I think it's great that 3,000 souls were baptized that day. But out of 3 million, that's not a great number.
Yeah. Well.
So you're going to have, you would have these scoffing because they don't believe, just like Paul, he didn't believe that sect or their way at first.
Yeah.
Because he was steeped in the Old Testament law, and that's where they were. And so it's no great amazement that they were bringing up any kind of excuse they could to try to put this down, because they thought it was just another second kind of time to come in, or somebody trying to teach something that was real.
Sure.
But they hadn't accepted it, and a bunch of them never did accept it.
Right. Yeah, Richard brings up a good point, and we don't intend by that to say that we have to worry about the proportions. If there were 3 million in the city, there certainly weren't 3 million gathered right outside where they were sitting. But we have been, of course, informed on many occasions that the way it's straight, and few there be that will seek after life, and that's the way it has been and always will be. There was a large group there. I don't know what proportion of those who heard that day became obedient to the gospel. It may have been a pretty good number, even percentage-wise. It was a significant event, after all. But there have been and always will be those who will scoff and be antagonistic toward the truth of God's Word. It's not any different today. And what we can learn from that is that though in our preaching of truth, we may not have quite the same results. I don't expect that this morning we're going to have 3,000 souls come forward to be baptized. But the fact remains that just as there was then, there is now. There are individuals who scoff and there are individuals who are receptive to the truth. And we need to seek them out and find the ones who are receptive to truth that their souls might be saved. Let's go on and begin to address the sermon itself. I know, like I said, we're not going to get through it in 3 weeks, but we'll see what we can get to. But let's begin with verse 14. Let's start off by making note of the prophecy of Joel. So if you'll begin reading with me in verse 14, and we will go down through verse 21 of the text. Peter is the voice that is primarily recorded in the text. And here we have in verse 14 the beginnings of his sermon. He stood up with the 11, raised his voice, and said to them, "Men of Judea and all who dwell in Jerusalem, let this be known to you and heed my words. For these are not drunk, as you suppose, since it's only the third hour of the day. This is what was spoken by the prophet Joel. It shall come to pass in the last days, says God, that I will pour out my spirit on all flesh. Your sons and your daughters shall prophesy. Your young men shall see vision. Your old men shall dream dreams. And on my men servants and my maid servants I will pour out my spirit in those days. And they shall prophesy. I will show wonders in heaven above and signs in the earth beneath, blood and fire and vapor of smoke. The sun shall be turned into darkness, the moon into blood, before the coming of the great and awesome day of the Lord. And it shall come to pass that whoever calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved." Now again, there are a couple of points that we want to make that I think are significant with regard to this text. Well, there are a lot of things in the prophecy itself. But first of all, let's note that prior to that, again, Peter deals rather dismissively with the claims that they were drunk. He simply makes note of the fact, in effect, it'd be like me saying, well, it's a ridiculous thing to say that these men are drunk only 9 o'clock in the morning, and then just go on to saying what it is. So it wasn't an attempt to deal significantly with that. It was something that was evident to all, again, who had open minds, that that claim, as they scoffed and said these men are drunk, was simply not true. And so he states that you know, it's the third hour of the day. Again, with regard to the Jewish reckoning of time, it would be 9 o'clock in the morning in which this this is taking place. And he said, no, that's not what it is. What it is a fulfillment of prophecy. And so he relates the prophecy. Now, again, when you look at the prophecy of Joel, one of the things that we want to make note of is verse 17, the statement that it shall come to pass in the last days. That what we are referring to here is the last days. And I think that you could say that this is the beginning of the last days. What we're talking about is the final piece of the puzzle. When you go back into the Gospels, you find an individual who lived, Jesus, and died. And he lived and died under the old law. In fact, when he came, it was his purpose to fulfill that law. Not one jot or tittle shall pass away by any means until all things are fulfilled, was the promise that he gave to his disciples. And indeed, he fulfilled those prophetic utterances concerning the coming of the Messiah and the establishment of that final kingdom in his power and glory were accomplished at his resurrection from the dead. Those things were done. And so all that had to be done under that previous dispensation to make available the opportunity for the new thing, the new covenant, the new kingdom, the new government were accomplished in his resurrection. And so basically, as we talked in some detail and some length about in Acts chapter 1, the Lord was saying, you just stay here in Jerusalem until you're endued with power. And again, the significance of that power is that the power would accompany the presentation of the kingdom. And so these events on this day are the culmination of all of those promises concerning what would happen in the last days, when there would be the establishment of another kingdom, when there would be a change with regard to the way God deals with man. And that's happening here on this occasion. And that's the significance of the prophecy in Joel. Now, if you'll notice, it states that there are certain things that will accompany these things. Now, as you look through the list in verses 17 through 21, it's obvious And again, you have to be careful with regard to this. Okay, this phrase is used, your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, your young men shall see vision, your old men shall dream dreams. Okay, now what is that referring to? What specific event is that referring to? And you can run into problems if you do that kind of thing. And again, some of these things that are mentioned, especially with regard to verses 19 and following, concerning the wonders in heaven and the signs on the earth, and blood and fire and vapor of smoke and such, that there is no indication that those things were seen. Those aspects of that prophecy were seen on that day. But what you have to understand is that the prophecy of Joel is indicating is that there is these last days. This is a period, an epoch, a duration of time that would take place when all of these events will happen. And I think as you look at the latter part of his prophecy, the most obvious and reasonable explanation would be to give is that those final descriptions are referencing the coming of our Lord, the second coming, and the end, or the dissolution of all things. That is the end of the last days. But here, what we have on this occasion is the beginning of those things. And these events which are transpiring on this occasion, this speaking in tongues, is the pouring out of the Spirit, which is the beginning of this occasion. And again, as Kelly alluded to a little bit earlier, the Jews most certainly should have been aware of what it was that was promised. They had that knowledge of the law. They were aware of the promises that were yet future, that yet were unfulfilled with regard to a kingdom, with regard to a Messiah. Of course, they rejected, many of them rejected Jesus, but the fact remains that they were aware of the teaching, and what he's saying is, what you've been waiting for all of this time, what you've been looking forward to all of this time, as you've been chafing under the rule of the Roman Empire, for example, all of those things, that's what is being accomplished today. This is not just some drunk standing up and making a ruckus. This is the most significant event of your lifetime, of your life, that's happening on this occasion. And utilize the prophecy from Joel, and of course later some arguments taken from the words of David, and then finally the evidence given with regard to the resurrection of Jesus himself to prove what it was that he was contending for, that this was something that was new, something that they needed to respond to in faith. So, with regard to, again, without going into great detail with regard to every clause with regard to the prophecy of Joel, the significance of that is found in the statement that this is that which is spoken of by the prophet Joel, that in the last days it shall come to pass, that this was a significant event. Now, if you'll notice in verse 22, as he draws that to a conclusion, he says, men of Israel, hear these words, Jesus of Nazareth. So he makes or attributes this to Jesus. I want you to notice as well as a part of that, verse 21. Verse 21. Now, in these last days, the promise is given that in these last days it shall come to pass that whoever calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. The phraseology that is mentioned in the prophecy that is recounted here by the Apostle Peter is one that is utilized on a number of occasions in the New Testament. Romans, the 10th chapter, Acts chapter 22, there are references to this calling on the name of the Lord. What we need to do, and what we will do as we continue our study of the second chapter of Acts, is to address what calling on the name of the Lord is. Some people will take that phrase and they'll say, okay, all I have to do is say, Lord, Lord, save me. That's calling on the name of the Lord. And, well, maybe so, maybe no. It just depends upon what the biblical definition of that calling is. It is an entreaty to God and on the name of Jesus. And that has reference to authority and what God requires. And we're going to talk about what that is as we continue in our study of the text. Now, so we look at it. Okay. In addition to that, we're about out of time, but in addition to that, you'll notice that the Spirit would fall upon all flesh. And again, I think that would indicate or refer not only to the Jews and not only to the disciples, but perhaps have a reference to the fact that the Gentiles would have inclusion into the kingdom. And of course, as we will continue our study of the book of Acts, we'll get to the 10th chapter and find out that Cornelius, who was a Gentile with his household, with his family, that they too received the baptism of the Spirit. Peter referring to the fact that it fell upon them as it had upon us in the beginning, which was a reference back to Acts the second chapter in the day of Pentecost. And so that Spirit was not poured out only upon the Jew, but also upon the Gentile in fulfillment of that prophecy of Joel. Okay, so that's basically, we'll wait till we get to verse 38 to talk a little bit more about the calling upon the name of the Lord, because that's the response that Peter gave to the question. But that covers basically what we want to talk about with regard to Joel's prophecy. Yes, Justin.
I just want to mention that here, going into the verse we'll look at next week, there's biblical and historical evidence that people were looking to the Messiah. Mentioned later on additional false Christ showing up.
Sure.
Things like that. And the prophecy of Daniel is one of the most blatant prophecies in the Bible, where you specifically mentioned the Greeks at one point. And there's one person that comes out and says, everyone knew that as well.
Right.
And there's evidence that perhaps, 300 or maybe more years, they've been looking for this Messiah.
Yeah, which is why Kelly said that he did, is they knew it and they should have recognized it, and maybe some of them did. You know, and certainly some responded to Peter's explanation. But yeah, it's the problem that existed, I think, primarily which led to the rejection of Jesus and the rejection of his kingdom by many in the first century, is that as time had gone, there were some peculiar views that had become pretty much characteristic of the entire population as to the nature of the kingdom.
Herod didn't latch on because he was afraid that Jesus would become king.
Right.
Pharisees that really thought that Jesus would become king and bring Israel back into power, they might have followed him.
Yeah, possibly. And you'll note that there was a group called the Zealots that were very much aware of those prophecies, as well as the time frame of the prophecies, and were actively looking for the Messiah at that time for the purpose of overthrowing the Roman government. I mean, they felt that the Messiah was going to come, and they were going to fight for him with swords and overcome the Roman government. There were many who were becoming very much involved with the teaching of Jesus and the ministry of Jesus until he himself put off some of the physical things that are physical expectations that they would have concerning a king. And because of his hard teachings, we're told that many turned away and served him no more. Jesus disappointed a Jewish people that were looking for a Messiah, because he wasn't the Messiah they were looking for. He was the only one, but they had peculiar views about that, and that's what led them to the rejection. But they should have known. They had sufficient evidence to know. And, of course, those who responded to the preaching here did, as a result of that, receive the salvation that was promised. We will pick up with probably verse 22 in our study next week. Thank you all for your kind attention and the good comments we had in class today.